The Truth News Network. When you can't tell the players without a scorecard, when men identify as women, white women identify as Native American, rich, privileged Hollywood types decry wealth and privilege, then go to jail for abusing their wealth and privilege, and no one has the brass to speak the truth? There's always TNN, the Truth News Network. And here to throw the lightning is Dan Newman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Truth News Network. If you'll remember, yesterday we threw some lightning. We got deep into terrorism, the difference between white supremacist and Muslim extremist terrorism in the U.S. Today, we'll step a little closer to America, but it will be no less controversial. We're discussing today a topic top of mind all over the United States, especially in the upcoming 2020 presidential campaign for those 20 already declared Democrat presidential candidates. Reparations, yes or no? Now, reparations for slavery is the idea that some form of compensatory payment needs to be made to the descendants of Africans who had been enslaved as part of the Atlantic slave trade. The most notable demands for reparations have been made in the United Kingdom and in the U.S. Caribbean and African states from which slaves were taken have also made reparation demands. These reparations are speculative. That is, they have never been paid. They can be contrasted with compensated emancipation, the money paid by some governments to some slave owners when slavery was abolished as compensation for their loss of property. Talks in the U.S. of reparations has ramped up the last few years. Groups like Black Lives Matter, along with the NAACP, and even members of the Congressional Black Caucus, have begun to push for at least serious conversations about reparations. And with that 2020 presidential election just around the corner, several of those already declared 20 Democrat presidential candidates are beating the reparations drum. Is it time for all of us to have serious discussions about reparations? We at Truth News Network think it's a bit premature to do that. Why? Because hardly anyone has looked into the history of slavery, asked all of the important questions to be able to knowledgeably get answer for those questions so as to understand if, what, and how the United States can even seriously consider reparations. So today, we begin the first serious conversation about reparations. It is just the first serious conversation we should have. So, what about support for reparations? Well, within the political sphere, only one major bill demanding slavery reparations has been proposed, the Commission to Study Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act, which former Representative John Conyers Jr., Democrat from Michigan, proposed unsuccessfully to the U.S. Congress every year from 1989 until his resignation in 2017. As the name suggests, the bill recommended the creation of a commission to study the impact of slavery on the social, political, and economic life of our nation. In 2014, American journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates published an article titled The Case for Reparations, which discussed the continued efforts of slavery and Jim Crow laws and made renewed demands for reparations. Coates makes reference to Representative Conyers' H.R. 40 bill, pointing out that Congress's failure to pass this bill expresses a lack of willingness to right their past wrongs. In September 2016, the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent encouraged Congress to pass that aforementioned H.R. 40 bill to study reparations proposals, but the working group did not directly endorse any specific reparations proposal. The report noted that there exists a legacy of racial inequality in the U.S., explaining that, and I'm quoting, despite substantial changes since the end of the enforcement of Jim Crow and the fight for civil rights, ideology ensuring the nomination of one group over another continues to negatively impact the civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights of African Americans today, end quote. The report notes that a dangerous ideology of white supremacy inhibits social cohesion among the U.S. population. In 1999, African-American lawyer and activist Randall Robinson, founder of the Trans-Africa Advocacy Organization, wrote that America's history of race riots, lynching, and institutional discrimination have resulted in $1.4 trillion in losses for African-Americans. Economist Robert Brown stated the ultimate goal of reparations should be to restore the black community to the economic position it would have had if it had not been subjected to slavery and discrimination. He estimates a fair reparation value anywhere between $1.4 to $4.7 trillion, or roughly $142,000 for every black American living today. So now, let's jump across the hall and look at the other side, opposition for reparations. Opposition to slavery reparations is reflected in the general population. In a study conducted by YouGov in 2014, only 37% of Americans believe that slaves should have been provided compensation in the form of cash after receiving freedom. Furthermore, only 15% believe that descendants of slaves should receive those cash payments. The findings indicated a clear divide between black and white Americans on the issue, as you can imagine. The study summarized their findings, noting, quote, only 6% of white Americans support cash payments to the descendants of slaves, compared to 59% of black Americans. Similarly, only 19% of whites and 63% of blacks support special education and job training programs for the descendants of slaves. Earlier this year, in 2019, Democrat Party presidential primary candidates and U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders was asked about reparations and responded that there are better ways to address the crisis in African American communities than writing a check. His words, writing a check. Conservative writer David Horowitz wrote a list of 10 reasons why reparations for slavery is a bad idea for blacks and racists too. He wrote that in 2001. He contends there isn't one particular group that benefited from slavery. There isn't one group that is solely responsible for slavery. Only a small percentage of whites ever owned slaves, and many gave their lives fighting to free slaves. And most Americans don't have a direct or indirect connection to slavery because of the United States' multi-ethnic background. And when he said that many gave their lives fighting to free slaves, let's remember, in the Civil War, 300,000 white Americans died fighting to end slavery. Conservative political commentator Dinesh D'Souza argues that African Americans are, quote, vastly better off than they would have been had their ancestors not endured captivity and European rule. He bases this assertion on the better economic conditions for African Americans than Africans, on average. In addition, columnist Stanley Crouch equated reparations with a form of victim studies and described demands for reparations as a, quote, racial complaint that has existed since the early 1960s. In 2014, in response to that article, The Case for Reparations, conservative journalist Kevin Williamson published an article titled The Case Against Reparations. Williamson explains, quote, the people to whom reparations are owed are long dead. Our duty is to the living and to generations yet to come, and their interests are best served by liberty and prosperity, not by moral theory. He goes on to argue that African Americans' political interests can be corrected through equality under the law, and their economic interests can be served through a dynamic and growing economy, preferably one in which the labor force is liberated from the dysfunctional antique Prussian model of education that contributes so much to black poverty. Another article opposing reparations to slavery was also published in 2014 by Canadian-American neoconservative political commentator David Frum. In his article titled The Impossibility of Reparations, he makes a 5-point case against slavery reparations. First, he predicts that a program providing reparations to blacks would be a slippery slope, for soon other historically discriminated minorities, such as women or Hispanics, would make similar demands. Second, he explains that deciding who qualifies for reparations would be an embittered, borderline impossible process. Third, he argues that a reparations program would produce enormous side effects. For example, Frum notes that providing reparations to blacks may be de-incentivizing them from working and expose one of America's least financially sophisticated populations to predatory practices. Fourth, Frum points out that the program could further exacerbate inequalities for, quote, when a government spends money on complex programs, the people who provide the service usually end up with much more sway over the spending than the spending's intended beneficiaries. Fifth, Frum argues that a reparations program would quickly lose legitimacy, for simply too many logistical problems would arise in deciding how to implement the distribution of money. Now, before we get into serious discussions about the process of reparations, we're going to look at the sources of slavery in the U.S., how and where it started, and its specifics as it pertains to this conversation about reparations. It gets deeper, so you sit tight. Right back after this at truthnewsnetwork.org.
Spin free, collusion free, obstruction free, fake news free, gluten free. Dan Newman, TNN, the Truth News Network.
Out for some Lay's and you face a test. Which tasty chip will be the best? Sour cream and onion, smoky barbecue. Cheddar, sour cream, salt and vinegar too. You sample them all cause the crisp is so good on your lips. Yeah. You left your wallet at home, but now you have a new best friend.
The many flavors of Lay's chips. One taste and you're in love.
If you're wondering what path to take in order to enhance your life, then check out the U.S. Army. As a soldier, you'll be able to choose from 150 skill opportunities, all of which will open doors to your future success. You'll be ahead of the curve, too, since you'll be training on the most high-tech, state-of-the-art equipment. You'll meet people from around the globe. You'll train with experts in their fields and learn something about yourself in the process. You'll also earn respect and accumulate money for college, including some hefty bonuses. And then one day, you'll wake up and think about what your life was like before the U.S. Army. And you'll realize that you found your calling. That this is exactly where you were supposed to be all along. There's Strong, and then there's Army Strong. To find out more, call 352-335-5600 in Gainesville or 904-964-2023 in Stark or go to GoArmy.com.
There's enough negative news. Too bad it's fake news. Looking on the brighter side, the Truth News Network.
TruthNewsNet.org.
And your ray of sunshine, Dan Newman.
You know, we could spend a lot of time talking about slavery overseas because there was and is a bunch of it way before slavery began in the United States or the New World that was as it was called originally. But let's look at slave history of the U.S. American plantations were dwarfed by those in the West Indies. About a quarter of U.S. slaves lived on farms with 15 or fewer slaves. In 1850, just 125 plantations had over 250 slaves. U.S. slaves were further removed from Africa than those in the Caribbean. In the 19th century, the majority of slaves in the British Caribbean and Brazil were born in Africa. In contrast, by 1850, most U.S. slaves were third, fourth, or even fifth generation Americans. Slavery in the U.S. was distinctive in the near balance of the sexes and the ability of slave population to increase its numbers by natural reproduction. Unlike any other slave society, the U.S. had a high and sustained natural increase in the slave population for more than a century and a half. In 1860, 89% of the nation's African Americans were slaves. Blacks formed 13% of the country's population and 33% of the South's population. In 1860 also, less than 10% of the slave population was over 50. Only 3.5% was over 60. The average age of first birth for slave women was around 20. Child spacing averaged about 2 years. The average number of children born to a slave woman was 9.2, twice as many in the West Indies. Most slaves lived in nuclear households consisting of two parents and children, 64% nuclear, 21% single, 15% no family. Mother-headed families were 50% more frequent on plantations with 15 or fewer slaves than on large ones. Smaller units also had a disproportionately large share of families in which the father and mother lived on different plantations for most of the week. Few slaves lived into old age. Between 1830 and 1860, only 10% of slaves in North America were over 50. Children entered the labor force as early as 3 or 4 years old. Some were taken into the master's house to be servants, while others were assigned to special children's gangs called trash gangs, which swept yards, cleared drying corn stalks from fields, chopped cotton, carried water to field hands, weeded, picked cotton, fed work animals, and drove cows to pasture. Boy, that sounds like a lot of fun. By age 7, over 40% of the boys and half the girls had entered the workforce. At age 11, boys began to transfer to adult field jobs. At the beginning of the 18th century, it was common for small groups of slaves to live and work by themselves on properties remote from their masters' homes. Half of all masters owned 5 or fewer slaves. While most small slaveholders were farmers, a disproportionate share were artisans, shopkeepers, and public officials. Prices of slaves varied widely over time, as you can imagine. During the 18th century, slave prices generally rose. Though they fell somewhat before the start of the Revolution, by the early 1790s, even before the onset of cotton expansion, prices had returned to earlier levels. Prices rose to a high of about $1,250 during the cotton boom of the late 1830s, fell to below half that price in the 1840s, and rose to about $1,450 in late 1850. Males were valued 10 to 20% more than females. At age 10, children's prices were about half that of a prime male field hand. By 1850, 64% of slaves lived on cotton plantations, 12% raised tobacco, 5% sugar, 4% rice. Among slaves 16 to 20, about 83% of the males and 89% of the females were field hands. The remainder were managers, artisans, or domestic servants. Growing cotton required about 38% of the labor of slaves. Growing corn and caring for livestock about 31%, improving land, constructing fences and buildings, raising other crops, and manufacturing products such as clothes. Slaves constructed more than 9,500 miles of railroad track by 1860, a third of the nation's total, and more than the mileage of Britain, France, and Germany's railroads combined. About two-thirds of slaves were in the labor force, twice the proportion among free persons. Nearly a third of slave laborers were children, and an eighth were elderly or crippled. Between 1790 and 1860, 835,000 slaves were moved from Maryland, Virginia, and the Carolinas to Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. Slaveholding became more concentrated over time. The fraction of households owning slaves fell from 36% in 1830 to 25% in 1860. If the North and South are treated as separate nations, the South was the fourth most prosperous nation in the world in 1860. We hear all the bragging now out of California about how if they were not a state but were a nation unto themselves, they would have, I think it's the third or fourth best economy, gross domestic product of any country on earth. Italy didn't achieve the southern level of per capita income until the eve of World War II. Civil War. During the Civil War, 140,500 freed slaves and 38,500 free blacks served in the Union Army. Well, let me ask you this. Those are the details, the fractions, the percentages, so you can kind of get a picture of where the people that were captured in slavery were living and the kind of lives that they were living. Can we make it work? This is the 900-pound gorilla in the reparations room. Who would qualify for reparations and how? From where would the money come? Why is such a system of collective repayment even being considered by a civilized society? Perhaps more fundamentally, why is anyone alive today deserving of compensation for servitude imposed upon their ancestors so many generations ago? And why should any living American be financially penalized for a system in which their distant ancestors may or may not have participated? Wealth distribution in the case of discussions about reparations is disguised as justice. Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Kamala Harris of California, both Democrats, you know who they are. They have signaled support for reparations for slavery, though both presidential candidates have been pretty vague on how such a proposal would work. Harris spoke to the New York Times of, quote, taking an approach that would change policies and structures and make real investments in black communities. Warren told the paper, quote, we must confront the dark history of slavery and government-sanctioned discrimination in this country that has had so many consequences, including undermining the ability of black families to build wealth in America for generations. We need systemic structural changes to address that. Notice, both senators, no plans for how to make it work, not even a hint of what their thoughts are. At the 30,000-foot level, it carries a lot more credibility than it does at the ground level, doesn't it? Nobody seems to be suggesting a system of specific payments to individuals, which would be an entirely unworkable idea. So it appears that the senators are pushing a redistribution of wealth and resources at the community level and justifying it by using the specter of slavery. Former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro is also in favor of reparations. Castro, another Democrat, has now thrown his hat into the ring for 2020. How could such a system of government-imposed wealth distribution along racial lines be considered just? Consider the statistical horrors of simply declaring that all white people, because of their skin color, must bear the guilt of slavery and that all black people, by virtue of their skin color, are the victims of this horrible system. Assigning blame, it's not a black and white issue, folks. To begin with, interracial relationships go back to the time of slavery and obviously became more common after the ending of segregation. According to 2017 figures from the Pew Research Center, 10% of children in America are mixed race. How many adults are of mixed race, whether they are aware of the fact or not? So how many white Americans have ancestors who were themselves slaves, and how many black Americans have ancestors who were slave owners? There are some in both of those classes. We just don't have any idea how many. Then, of course, there is the obvious fact that a percentage of blacks living in America today immigrated long after slavery was abolished and the last child of the last slave died. Perhaps they were actually born in the U.S., but their parents and grandparents immigrated to America. Those blacks were never victims of American slave traders or slave owners. Remember this. A percentage of blacks living in America today immigrated long after slavery was abolished. There are even more statistics that illustrate the unfairness of a blanket assignment of racial victimization. While the percentage of whites in America who actually owned or rented slaves is unverifiable, there is no dispute that, even in those states where the owning of slaves was most common, less than 50% of white families owned slaves. Less than half. In many other states, that percentage was far lower. Across all the slave states combined, only about a quarter of the white population owned slaves, and on a national scale, that figure falls to something under 10%, though those figures are uncertain, since some people on both the political left and right offer different numbers to either increase or decrease the impact of slavery. Also, historical research reveals that in 1830, some 3,700 blacks, themselves freed slaves, owned a combined total of almost 13,000 slaves. So let's wrap up this conversation today about reparations in America. With this thought, we'll begin our summary. Historical sins cannot be erased by dollars. If there is any moral justification to direct funds and other resources from certain states and communities to certain other states and communities based on some unprovable notion of who was and who was not implicated in the slave trade is simply impossible to justify. And it's even more impossible, I don't think that you can say that, impossible or more impossible, there's no way to implement a fair plan. More importantly, we cannot alter the past. No amount of reparations will ever undo the human catastrophe that was the slave trade or erase the collective disregard that one group of humans had for another. It's just not going to happen. That is impossible. It doesn't matter if you rewrite history. You don't change history, and we can't do away with our past. If the reparations Pandora box for slavery is opened, that same door is open for many other similar instances, like indentured servanthood being chief among those. You remember what an indentured servant was? I have family relatives, ancestors, that came over from Northwest Europe as indentured servants. They weren't technically slaves, but some wealthy person would contract with my ancestors to come over and work at their place in the new land for a period of years. Those wealthy people would house and feed them. They would work basically for nothing. And for the housing, the transportation over, the food, taking care of them for those years, they had to work it off. And at the end of that time, they were given their freedom. How would you handle that? That's certainly not being free people. Then there are Native Americans and the way they were treated. Like the Nazi Holocaust, slavery should never be forgotten. But it is a wrong. It can never be put right. And any suggestion that modern society can somehow retroactively erase slavery's injustices from history is entirely disingenuous. The whole concept of reparations to one racial group completely discounts individual rights and imposes collective rewards and punishments based upon which demographic group is favored. It is an idea that can only further aggravate racial tension, mistrust, and even open animosity. There was a time when conscientious Americans proudly used the term post-racial. Today it appears that reparationists are hell-bent on dividing Americans along racial lines to a degree not seen since the 1960s. We are far away from knowing all of the ins and outs that would somehow allow serious consideration of reparations. To get there, civic and political leaders need to somehow get in a room with no guns, no knives, leaving the animus of racial injustice at the door, and discuss realistic ways of looking at this issue. And that's the key. Realistic ways of looking at this issue. Some would say coming into the room and leaving guns and knives at the door would be the critical issue. Anyway, unless and until that all happens, multiple generations of Americans, none of which were ever slaves, will be daily living with that 900-pound gorilla still running around the room looking for answers. Folks, this issue will probably still be an unresolved issue in 2050. Hey, if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Beto O'Rourke are right, it won't make any difference. AOC says we won't be here in 12 years. Beto says the end is coming and we'll be here in just 10 years. Folks, I'm sorry we reached the end of this story today without giving you a firm, solid answer about reparations. It's all opinion. There is not a lot of factual opportunity to come up with a plan. And I don't know that dollars and cents in the form of real reparations will ever be worked out here in the U.S. But while this conversation goes on, you make sure you stay close because we're on top of it. And I promise you, as we run up to the 2020 presidential election, those campaigning will certainly, somebody's going to jump out there and maybe, just maybe, offer a firm plan. I don't know. But we'll be on top of it if and when it happens, along with everything else. Stay with us here at truthnewsnet.org. Until we talk again, have a great day. So long, everybody.
Spin free, collusion free, obstruction free, fake news free, gluten free. Dan Newman, TNN,
the Truth News Network.